Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ciaffardini. Thank you so very much for coming back to the Ghost Seat Talk podcast experience. Be careful what you wish for. You want to get close to your heroes. You want to get in the movies. Whenever you play a video game, the grand hope is that what you saw on a silver screen is going to be replicated infinitely on a video game. Aliens Dark Descent is a journey into the madness. Aliens 1, 2, and 3 are such a big part of our lives, and we are thrilled to be speaking to the man, the myth, the legend, who is extending that sonic palette into the alien atmosphere, either sphere, other verse. Doyle Donahue is the composer, Aliens Dark Descent. Thank you for being on the show, Doyle.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Fine. Yes, I've been doing a number of interviews about Dark Descent, so... it's always fun to do. You know, I like really blabbering on about myself and my music, so that's not a hard thing, I don't think. So, anyway, you were talking about. I'd like to start out with talking about exactly what you were talking about. The hope that you will be immersed in the alien environment, and that was probably my first thought when I got this job. Is that and discussing it with the developers, we're all on the same page. Too often. You know, you see a movie and it's really great, and then the sequel comes out and you're disappointed because they just didn't follow up with the premise of the first movie. Not only maybe partially or not in any way. You're so disappointed. I did not want that people to be disappointed when they play this game. I wanted it to sound like an alien franchise movie. I wanted it to sound like what you heard in the first three movies. I wanted that sonic environment to immerse the players in. And that was my goal. I think is the same goal for the developers too, because they pretty much, went after the same kind of similar environments in the game as well, you know, with ships and colonies and industrial environments and stuff like that. So yes, we didn't want to disappoint the fans. And I was one of them, you know. I didn't want to be disappointed.
Well, fair enough. You know, I think there's a current vernacular that's been going around: the geek shall inherit the earth. And right now, the things that we grew up with, things that were so special to us, have really become, I don't know if it's zeitgeist, but like the things that we wanted to either have sequels, or I'm speaking specifically about Back to the Future video game, the NES game that nobody liked, and then they made 2 and 3 and it was terrible. So exactly like we're speaking the same thing, that what people are making now is the stuff that we wish we had when we were younger. I remember going through a toy store and I saw a Predator toy, and I thought, man, I was such a big fan of Predator. Why didn't they have this when I was 9? So it's so great that this stuff exists, because people are so passionate and they have the funds and the creative facilities to produce it. So I want to say some names out loud. I want to say Goldsmith. I want to say Horner. I want to say Goldenthal. And I want to say Donahue. You are part of the four horsemen of the Xenomorph apocalypse. So I have nothing but praise for you, Doyle. And I want to say that as soon as the first couple notes of the main title came on, you made me feel as if that I got thrown back into my 9-year-old body. Yes, I saw Aliens when I was 9, and I was in that world.
Original program, because I saw it like 9 or 10 times in movie theater, and this is one of the programs that I got when I watched the movie. And I have a whole stack of books here, because one of the things I was really interested in was, like, for example, this one, I was really interested in the graphic arts, because we had Mobius doing the spacesuits, and we had a guy named Cobb doing from LA doing a lot of what they call the NASA interiors, and of course H.R. Giger doing the alien. And so this book in particular, you know, really goes through all of the artists and the artwork that went into the movie. And I was really into graphic arts at the time, so I really appreciated that aspect, because I thought it was a very, very artistic movie. I mean, you could see it all there on the screen. It was all put on the screen there. And so, and then, you know, great story. And, you know, and I see, I just go through these. And as you can tell, that the movie was pretty popular after it came out, you know. And here's the picture, not this one, is another thing. Here's the picture book of all the of alien stuff. So yeah, I was collecting, and I was collecting, of course, all the soundtracks, of course. You know, I didn't get, of course, CDs weren't available when it came out. So I got it on a vinyl, and I practically wore out the grooves of on the records, you know, analyzing and playing them over and just listening to it for fun. And then later on, all the versions of the soundtracks, the reprinting, the you know, remastering and all the other stuff, you know, I got all of those 12 and ripped them a lot and listened to them and analyzed them. And so I had so by the time the Aliens job came along, I was pretty much familiar with the whole, you know, all the Alien music. Plus, a lot of my clients referenced the Alien scores for their games. And, you know, they were drawing from that as well as, you know, especially the emotions and the feeling that you're immersed in by the Alien music. And that's what I was going for the game. I wanted to immerse everybody back into the Alien environment, you know, because as I pointed out some other people, I said, when I first watched Alien, and they've done different versions, which is kind of it's kind of sad, but the very first version I saw of the movie when it first came out, they had the, you know, the planet there and the Stromo slowly going across there, and they started doing the lettering, and it was also playing the music. Now, and when they did that at the beginning of the movie and playing that music, I was totally creeped out. I mean, I was a space fan and, you know, science fiction fan, and I was actually thinking, maybe we don't belong out there. You know, I mean, it was totally freaking me out. And so I wanted that for the people, for the fans, for the people watching the game. And I hope that's what we deliver. No, I think we did. I mean, I think we did deliver.
1,000% yes. And more to that point, you said you wore out the grooves trying to figure out how the palette worked. So that you've already done your homework before you even got this job. Oh, yeah. But, you know, one of the most amazing things about being a soundtrack fan or score fan is that when I listen to something, I have no idea what produces what sound. So was there any mysteries left uncovered when you started this job? Were you trying to figure out? I mean, the things in, I'm a big fan of James Horner's work, the tap, tap, tap and the screeching strings. And it seems like you not only took that, sourced it, but then expanded on it. But was there anything left in the bucket? Like, how, you know, how did they do that? Or what was that sound? Or,
well, I suppose, you know, there's more things where you could come up with, or just things that are fairly subtle that you probably, just not aware of. Like, for instance, one of the sounds for Alien, when the Alien sounds, is this bassoon flutter tom. And I did a little of that, but, you know, that's not one of the primary sounds you hear. But, you know, the really good composers out there who, you know thousands of orchestral devices. And so when they come up to the challenge of this movie, a movie like Alien, you know, they have a big bucket to draw from, a lot of ideas. So they probably didn't empty the bucket. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, if I was to do a sequel to this game, I'd find more things that were Alien and Alien-centric. But not only that, in the last 10 to 15 years, the sound possibilities are much larger. I mean, the sound palettes out there that is available to composers is really huge now. I mean, before everything was done in orchestra, you know, you couldn't do it in an orchestra, you didn't get it recorded. But I mean, after a while, that started changing, you know. I mean, to the point now where you have Dune, and Dune was almost entirely synthetic. Most of the 2-CD storybook, whatever they called it, for Dune, and that was all you would call synthetic. There was no real orchestral stuff played. But in the movie itself, there was some orchestral things. But most of the sound palette was something we called synthetic. Did not come from orchestra. So, and we call that, in the composer world, we call that hybrid music. And so, so I would probably, if I'm doing more on land, I'd probably be leaning more towards a hybrid thing, but at its base, I'd still stay with orchestral arrangements. So that'd be the foundation still. And I'd let all the grace notes and the flourishes and all the other kind of stuff, extra sounds that, you know, that could be layered on top of that, but the foundation would still be at its base orchestral.
Well, there is a huge distinction about music that's done for a movie where you're a passenger on this journey. And I would like to say that, unfortunately, when I listen to, say, Aliens, it doesn't have what I would say a great experience outside of the film. I mean, it's a great musical work, and I know that and all the other Alien scores so well, but there's certain audience, a gap in the audience or listening experience. But I have to say that listening to your work, because of what I guess the frenzied nature of the video game, I can find myself listening to this score front to back without feeling like, well, there's lulls or it's building like it was in the Aliens movie. For instance, my favorite track is probably Desperate Escape. I mean, it's got a lot of energy and it keeps a very constant pace. And then you have a track called Alien First Encounter, where you mentioned before the difference between synthetic and symphonic. You got a lot of, there's some Vangelis type synth work, but then it's very pulsing and frenzied. So what I'm getting at in all this, this is like Aliens on steroids. So the listening experience is, outside of the game, it's equally as entertaining.
Well, a lot of movie scores are intentionally, I mean, that's their purpose, is to be back score. Howard or one of the other composers once said, I don't compose for silence. You know, he composes for dialogue, sound effects, and video. And that's, you know, that's basically the way I would think too. The only difference is I think I come from a rock background and I played in metal bands and prog rock bands, and I produced my own album at one time, a solo album where I played all the instruments and that sort of thing. So, you know, I started from the point of being a songwriter. So definitely, you know, I try to make things backscore when they need to be backscore, but also, you know, I'm always conscious of putting some kind of melodic element in there so that it can be more listened to. I think you're right that maybe the first score Alien, the first score Alien is more musical than maybe the second one. But I think that's because Horner was really concentrating on the backscore element of things. Because you listen to Horner stuff on its own, and like I say, it doesn't stand up quite as well as the score for Alien, which you can actually put a record on and do your Asmar thing, you know, with it, you know, and be fun to listen to. So, I don't know, did I answer the question? I'm not sure there.
Tangential. You did. And I would say for a lifelong film score, I feel ashamed for saying I've never heard the expression backscoring, but I think you learn something new every day. So, and I'd like to think that I spoke to a video game composer not too long ago, and he told me a lot of the efforts that he takes in doing his work is it. You try to create some highs and lows so that as the players are experiencing the game, it's not everything high and it's not everything is not at a low. So you have to, you know, whether you're progressing at a through the game at a good pace or it's taking more time, it should never feel like I'm getting tired of hearing this music or it doesn't work with the gameplay. So how did you work with the gameplay to feather in your music?
Well, I think for games that are like first-person shooters, there's not a room for a lot of highs, and especially lows. There's a lot of room for highs because it's constant action. So, and that can be kind of tiring too. And we have to write for that sort of thing, you know, if you're in a first-person shooter. And it's a different sort of thing. I worked on a lot of real-time strategy games, like especially for Warhammer. But I think, you know, Aliens Dark Descent is more like the movies where there's, you know, long periods of maybe quiet and maybe not so much things going on, and then things hitting a peak, you know, and then tapering off. I mean, a lot of movies, I mean, this is not like, you know, composing for a movie. A lot of movie has an arc. It usually starts off real high and has a low point in the middle somewhere, and it builds up to the end, you know, and then you can follow that arc musically if that's the way you're directed. But for video games, you can't really rely on that because it's an ever-evolving environment, and the things that happen in a game don't always happen at the same place at the same time like it does in a movie. It depends on how you're doing and how you're exploring and what you discover in the game, and that it triggers certain things within the game. So we had a lot of concepts that we wanted to address in the game. There was the initial you know, like say they were in a spaceship sort of environment, and everything's dark and the power's off, and they're going through there. So we have this very quiet kind of environment with very, very subtle music. And then and then they discover something that starts to tell the story. And then you come up with music that's more storytelling, than just the atmospheric stuff. And then maybe later on you get to a point where you have like first encounter, where you may meet a couple of the aliens and they find out just how deep the doo-doo they're in, and that goes on when you're still exploring and you're getting more storytelling and there's more encounters, and then till you're working up until what we call in the game industry the boss fight, and that's where you get your real big, huge, heavy load of action music, that sort of thing. But that whole spectrum there has to be filled by the music, or not. Sometimes you have to value the silence too. I think some game developers don't really get the value of silence and how silence works, because if you watch movies enough, you see there's lots of periods where there's silence. They let the dialogue carry it, or just the atmospheric sound carry it. But so you don't have to fill every second with music, even though, in the last 30 years, music is exponentially expanded as for how much it appears in movies. Because if you go back to the old movies and black and white and the early days of color movies and stuff, you don't hear a lot of music. If you really listen, there's not a lot of music in the movie. But as the whole industry matured to the present state, music became more and more of an important part of the movie. And I think that it really exploded when Star Wars came along, because it was wall-to-wall music pretty much during the entire movie. And everyone loved it. Well, John Williams, So I think there's been that kind of progress for sort of things. And my job to do is to fill these needs in the game, under direction, and match the music to the moods that they're trying to portray, and try to tell the story like they want it to be told.
Well, one of the ways that you tell a story, I'm speaking specifically about Desperate Escape and They Keep Coming, you use what I might imagine as not sound effects. Like there's a breathing in Desperate Escape, and then there's a ding, 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 which I believe Horner did that sort of chime, that rhythmic chime. So how do you introduce maybe your new bits to the palette, and how do you expand it with things that aren't so-called instruments, so to speak?
Yeah, you're talking about that anvil sound, ding ding, ding ding. Yeah, I couldn't wait to be able to use that in an alien game, because I said I thought way back when that if I ever did an alien game, that sound's going to be part of the track, and it's going to be during an action scene. And there you go, there it is. And I definitely was. I'd been using it in other music and stuff like that, but for Alien, especially this Alien game, I especially was looking forward to putting that sound in there, as well as many of the others sort of thing. And yes, and it usually for those kind of parts, it is a pulsing, driving kind of sound and music that you want to go in there. And you could call anvil as a sound effect, but really it's still an orchestral device. I mean, it's like, for example, there's subtle piano in there. And piano is considered to be a percussion device because it has hammers. Yeah, that's right. And so you can use piano like a percussion device, especially in the low end. I really loved pounding in some of these piano notes in the low end, especially for action sequences. It really gives a kind of a low growl percussive sound to things. I mean, things like that. And plus, I listen to, like, as you can imagine, I listen to the scores a lot. So I wanted to duplicate some of those feelings too, because I wanted the game players to be comfortable with the environment that they know that they're in deep doo-doo now. If you're in an action scene and you're at this kind of action music and you hear those anvils going there, you better check your ammo, you're in for a fight. Anything more about that? Did I get that all?
I'm so glad to know it was an anvil. I remember talking to Don Davis about the Oh gosh, I'm blanking. It's in the Matrix. Pile driver. He was a pile driver. Dunk, dunk. It was like a persistent, and it was a driving element to the score, and it was not what you would call a traditional orchestral instrument. So I'm just curious, each of these composers who have come before you have created their palette, expanded on the palette, and I was just curious what else that you wanted to put, like you've been excited to use that, but what else were you looking at? Like, when I get my time, I'm gonna do a tambourine or like whatever it is. Like, what helped make this so flourish or so full-bodied?
Well, there's the usual suspects. We're doing, driving, string staccatos and basses, and of course percussion and snares and things. And you add that in with the anvils. And by the way, it's not just when they bring in these special percussion sometimes for orchestras. It's not only anvils, but they're like iron bars and kind of tubes, metal tubes and stuff like that. Depends on the composer and what he wanted to put in there, So, and I think it gets. I think that of all the sections of music that's in the Alien scores and mine is that the traditional music approach usually was happened during the more action scenes. So, I mean, that's where you rely more on orchestral traditions to drive the music forward, and I think that's pretty much what I did. I mean, I add some things, but I pretty much let the traditional approach to orchestral music to being the more dominant thing there. I just added some of the other stuff as frosting, like the anvils and crazy bassoons and flutter tongues and stuff like that. For example, one of the a lot of things that are in there are flutter tongues for horns and flutter tongues for bassoons and contra bassoons. I think that's just some things you can add as a in the way it's done. The way at least I did it was they're more like percussive kind of element and they're very rhythmic kind of elements. Anything that it can be evocative of something that's not quite human and a bit alien in its in the feeling. That it's got beyond the scope of traditional orchestra. I mean, that's kind of what you kind of shoot for. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain. I mean, one person I heard say something like, talking about music's like tap dancing about football. You have to. I could probably show you musically what I mean, but it's hard to. It's sometimes it's hard to exactly explain it because it's just part of the creative process. You have the feeling you're immersed in what the developers and producer directors are doing, and you're going with the flow and you're putting stuff in there, you're building on that, and you're grabbing for certain instruments and stuff to add to the feelings until you come up with a full composition for a section. So it's not cut and dried like I went from a G major 7 to the F here with the flutes and followed by the bassoons and the low end. That's describing the tools, but it's not describing the creative process. And the creative process is kind of hard to explain all by itself. I mean, the proof is what you hear in the music. That's what I was reaching for. What happened in the music is what I was reaching for. And I got there by going through a creative process of experimentation and using, starting from the base of a, traditional orchestra and just building on that, but still keeping in mind, I want it to feel alien, And I mean, that was the overarching concern. I wanted it to feel alien, especially feel like it was influenced by the first three movies scores, especially the first. So I don't, that's about as far as I can explain it.
Let's go a bit deeper because I think this is both fascinating and it's going to help me understand what it is to be a composer. Because yes, I understand it's difficult to explain the creative process, but here's a for instance or something to gravitate towards. I work in architecture. What I do for this website is a hobby. So if somebody comes to me and they say, "Hey, we want a hotel," at least you know the limits. And if you say, well, you need 360 rooms, okay, and a restaurant and a bar, you kind of have an idea of what it's going to take to fill this creative bucket. So when somebody comes to you and says, hey, we're going to base a sound palette on a movie that's 105 minutes, versus when you have gameplay that could span 60, 70 hours. I guess how do you look at what a finish line is and say, hey, I'm going to do something for a video game, and how do you define a perimeter, and then how do you fill that bucket?
Well, you bring up a kind of interesting question. We're talking about, of doing an hour's worth of music for maybe a 40-hour game. And we're thinking about that up front and how we construct the music. And we actually took a different approach to some of the music. Some of the music that if you listen to the score is like, 10 minutes long for some of the tracks and everything. That's
like
because
the discovery track was about nine minutes, 10 minutes.
Yes. And so the reason why it was created like that is because, as I discussed earlier, we went from a point where, a kind of a standstill of an environment. We started building on that environment. We had discovery, we had storytelling, and then we had encounters. And I wanted all that to be worked together as a whole. So it was a lot of this section was composed as a whole, from finish to from the very beginning atmospheric part to the very to the almost to the climactic stuff. The very climactic stuff, we called like the boss fights, that was separately done because it's a separate entity. It's more like first person shooter stuff, but up to that point, there was a lot of things we could do in there, and we wanted all this to smoothly fit together. So it was written on a, in a very long track with a lot of these, a lot of these points being filled. And I couldn't do it against a movie or a game or anything on gameplay. I just had to, use the resources they give me for the various sections and create those parts. But the nice thing about it is all the continuity of it. So here you have something that's like, 10 or 20 minutes long, and you have, like 20 stems tracks that they could go through and edit. So now they have a resource that they can pluck and take out and edit and fit it to the game with the various sections so that they can smoothly go from one thing to the other. Because it was all composed together, it was very easy to put together and to make it go from one mood to another rather smoothly, because that's the way it was kind of created. I mean, it may not be a perfect way of doing things, but it was definitely something that I think worked for us. So that, but I get back to your architecture sort of thing. I mean, you go through the same process as I do when it comes to composing. I mean, you get a framework to work with. You know what's there. You can parse out the lines and everything where everything's going to be. But then you start getting into the details, and there's where you have to be more artistic. You have to be creative as to how you are going to build your environments in your architectural designs to make it something that people really like and there are people are pleased with, which is no different than what I do. I'm doing the same thing. I have a start with a structure. Sometimes it comes from the game, sometimes it comes from me, or it comes from the story or whatever, or the video and stuff like that. And I have that framework, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm putting down the framework of how I'm going to propose this, and then I start filling it in with the more creative things. So you can see that. I mean, yeah, well, those things in life are connected. Architecture and music. Hey.
Well, that's the funniest parallel is that the more I speak to composers, I realize that the process is the same. But I think what you were saying earlier just it visually helped me visualize it. The point where that's the reason we develop palettes, because we know what we want to, we know how we want something to feather out. And if you need to stop it here, well, that means that this tile or this horn goes to this point, and then after that it transitions to something else. So it's a way of visualizing something that I'm just used to very tangible things, where I think with the sound palette it can be intangible, especially if you're not in the industry like myself.
It's funny you should say that, because to me, I find it very tangible. I mean, I can almost see sounds and I see music. For me, it's a very solid thing that I'm working with. I mean, some of the things come from very solid things, orchestral instruments. I know what they're capable of and what their limitations are. And other instruments, I have that all day. And it seems all very physical to me. So they're like building blocks for me. It's like, tiles are building blocks for you. You put I mean, like programming and music, it's very similar, and it might be for architecture too, is that you take a lot of very simple things and you put them together to make something that ends up being very complex, perhaps, or maybe very beautiful or flowing. But it starts very simple with the simple components that you start putting together to make something bigger than, more than the sum of its parts, you know. So, and I suspect that's what you do in architecture too, because you have to trend, you have to put things together, it has to flow, and it has to transition from one environment to the other smoothly. So if you're doing that and thinking in those terms, well, it's not that much different for composers.
And that's why, like you said, the details are important, because a lot of it, you know, you could just have one piece of metal running everywhere, but it needs to feather or transition or so. This is great. This is great, Joel. We just became kindred spirits. This is awesome.
Oh, good. I think that always helps in communication. We have a point of reference. Yeah. So.
So, talk to me about cutscenes versus dramatic gameplay. Do you have more of a hand in how the music is input when it's a more like a narrative of a movie versus when it's kind of chaotic and free range gameplay?
I can speak to cutscenes, individually, because they're more like mini movies. And the thing about cutscenes is that they're fixed. You know, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know where it's going, and you can easily spot it as to how you want things to flow. And I just did a couple of episodes for Warhammer Plus, and it's the same kind of thing, only it's much longer. We're talking about, you know, 20 minute videos being scored. But once again, it's all fixed. It doesn't, matter of fact, one of my requirements for doing these videos is that it is fixed, that they only give me a version of the work, even if it's an animatic, that's time locked. So everything is, all the events are time locked. Because once it's all time locked, I can hit all the events. And gotcha, then we go through gotcha. It before I start composing. We have spotting sessions, and we figure out what they want to hear during very important parts of the video and what it should sound like. And that could take a couple of days, even for our 20-minute movie, you know, as we go through individually things, scene by scene, you know, discussing how these things can work out. And so, you know, cutscenes are like miniature versions of those things. You know, they have, like I say, beginning, middle, end. They had reached a certain point, and they're usually telling a part of a story, which is always fun. Whereas a gameplay is a little more amorphous, you know, because you have to write for things that are, and like I say, once again, you're talking about an hour's worth of music covering a 40-hour game. It has to be a little more amorphous and flexible, so that could cover a lot of different situations without it becoming redundant, you know, or stupid sounding, you know, which can be. You know? So, did we answer the question here? Or did I leave it off somewhere?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what the way I thought it was going to be. I thought with the cutscenes is pretty easy, but especially like you said, once you know what your limits are and it's locked, it's a lot easier to sort of dial in and put.
The only reason, like doing a TV series might be harder than doing video games, is that TV series are always under constant deadlines, and there's always too little time to do things. So the creative people are usually run ragged, you know, and that goes for movies too, you know, run ragged because they have these really harsh deadlines that they have to hit. Otherwise, you know, things bottleneck. Project managers get on your case, and I know because I used to be a project manager. So that'd be the difference. But if you have plenty of time to work on videos and movies and episodes, I think it's a lot simpler than doing video games. In video games, you have to kind of plan for a more fluid environment where things can happen asynchronously. Yeah, there's trade-offs for doing one or the other. I'd probably get bored if I had to do only one, you know, all the time, you know. I'd be longing to do the other if I was doing the one for too long, you know. But yeah, it's fun. It's one of the nice things about being a composer is you can do different things and do different environments and different kinds of music. And yeah, it's just, you know, variety, spice of life.
Well, you certainly spiced up the alien world. That's for instance, I'm going to go or for, that's for sure. I want to go back to what I said before. You make this listening experience so so dramatic and impacting. And I think that, not discrediting any of the previous composers who helped pave the way, but I think there's something enjoyable about this hour of music. To round out this interview, seems like you're such a big fan of the series, the world, the ether that these xenomorphs exist in. You have all those great pieces of memorabilia. If we can add to your collection, this, you're gonna have to go with me on this. If you can have a character from any of the series come visit you and bring a weapon and one of the aliens, what character would you want to come visit you? What prop or weapon or piece of hardware, and what alien would you like to come visit you?
I was always like Michael Biehn, and, you know, and he's done some interesting stuff. I met him once at a Comic-Con and had a little discussion with him about some things, but I really like him and his characters, and he always seems to deliver on whatever character he is doing. I mean, he has Terminator franchise, and he has Alien franchise, you know, and they're still going great guns. I'm sure he's getting a lot of residuals. So that'd be fun to spend more time with him and talk about things. Of course, having the alien with him, I'm not so sure I wanted one of those. I know people are real fanatics about it. They're like get full scale, you know, aliens, you know, I wouldn't know what to do with that. My studio is such that you don't walk into it. You have to kind of sidle your way into it and turn around slowly, because it's more like the cockpit of the space shuttle, you know, because I'm surrounded by monitors and, you know, and racks full of stuff and keyboard and stuff like that. So it wouldn't go in the studio. It'd probably be a poor companion if it was in my bedroom. So, But yeah, that'd be
fun. We'll go miniatures. We'll go 6-inch.
We'll go miniatures. Yeah, miniatures are fine. I collect little miniatures that are sitting on my keyboard in my studio, and like this one here. Let's see if you can see it, but it's from Doom.
Oh, okay. That's one of the first
from Doom. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the very first original thing, which is a game I used to play all the time, was Doom. I can't play first person shooters anymore because I get horribly sick. I get motion sickness like crazy. So, but the first, that's why I like RTSs, you know, and things like Alien Dark Descent, is because it's all third person kind of thing, and it doesn't get me all sick. I mean, I'd love to have played Modern Warfare or something like that, but I'd be sick within 5 minutes, and I had to have a crushing headache, and I wouldn't be able to go on. It's very disappointing that I can't do that anymore. So.
Well, I have one more question. You may be able to answer it, you may not. There is a very famous, what's called cinematic cheat that James Cameron had to do in the opening of Aliens.
A cheat or a
sheet? Cheat, C-H-E-A-T,
okay,
where he was trying to stretch his dollars on the set of Aliens. When the crew is awakening from their hypersleep, he used a mirror on the back of the pods, so it looked like there were more Marines waking up. So when all of those canopies, those clear crystal or glass canopies opened, I think there was only three of them. The mirror made it look like there were six, or whatever it was, it doubled it. So that's the way he got around finances. So are there any like economy to what you're doing?
I'll tell you another trick they used in Alien 2, Aliens as well, is that they used must have been the same mirror, because they had this hallway that they built, you know,
okay,
and it was a finite distance, and they put a mirror at the end of it and probably slanted it a bit so it looked like it curved off a little bit in order to double the length of the look of the hallway. So yeah,
okay,
that mirror tricks were pretty common and everything. Economy tricks of my own?
Or just in the industry, like so something that, you know, doubling up this, you know, the size sound of a symphony. I'm just guessing.
Well,
here
I have, you know, I don't know if this really would mean anything to, but I have tons of virtual instruments. I've been doing virtual orchestration since 2000, when computers finally got, you know, powerful enough to have virtual orchestrations. And at the moment I have like over 4 terabytes of instruments, and that's Alex, I may not mean anything to, but that's a lot of instruments. I mean, I can, there's so many patches and instruments that I can't use them all. I mean, my template that I use is over 1500 tracks. So, I mean, that's my palette that I work with, is that So if I need something, I go, you know, I just go to that section and dig around for, and if I have to, I'll go to the actual instrument and try different patches and to change it with what it was from the way it was set originally. So, but as for Trix itself, I think, well, some people would argue that virtual orchestration is kind of a trick in itself, is that I don't need to hire, you know, 100 musicians in a hall and a conductor and a person to deal with the sheet music and all that other kind of expense. I mean, I'm a one-man, you know, orchestra. And I mean, that's the way I've been doing things since, you know, ever since I was a kid. You know, I was always doing my own recordings and doing it all myself. And I probably quit the last band, or didn't get into any more bands after the last band collapsed, because I just wanted to do it all myself. And the funny thing is, the MIDI revolution came along, and then I could do it all myself. And that's always been my approach to being able to do things all myself at first with virtual orchestration. And it was very convenient too for a lot of the industry, because, you know, before, you know, people couldn't get an idea of what the score was going to sound like until it was actually done. And now today you can do that. You can actually do a scores that were pretty much done and finished. I mean, when, you know, Hans Zimmer was doing Gladiator and some of his early stuff, he went out and actually recorded his own samples and stuff for orchestra and stuff. And you can listen to his stuff and it sounds pretty good, but it was a long time ago. It sounds pretty good, but it was good enough so that he could show, you know, Ridley Scott or whoever, you know, exactly what it was going to sound like. And people like, that's one of the reasons why Hans Zimmer and other got popular, is because they could actually show people what the score is going to sound like. And I think we also had him and I and people like Denny Elfman and Brian Tyler and others had advantage too, is we come from a rock and roll background, you know, and we can think in classical terms, but we also think of rock and roll terms when it comes to music, which is like, you know, beginning, middle, end, chorus, verse, that kind of thinking and songwriting that isn't really conducive to classical tradition. So we've taken, you know, that kind of rock and roll approach and applied it to the orchestra and hybrid kind of music. And I think it made perfect sense for a lot of backscore that was needed for movies and stuff. And so anyway, I guess back to the point of, you know, I guess it's, if we're talking about some kind of cheat or something, I suspect that, you know, I come from the virtual tradition and I don't need all the extra performers. I mean, I have nothing against them. Matter of fact, I'd love to have one of my scores being performed at Air Lyndhurst in England by the LSO. You know, I'd love that. I would want to be there. I'd be there with cameras and, you know, movie cameras and all kinds of recorders and stuff like that. I definitely would want to see that, but it's not totally necessary for what I do. I mean, it's just one of those little benefits. So yeah, I am the cheat. I am the shortcut. So if you want to put it that way.
Fair enough. Well, you know, speaking from an architecture standpoint, we designers, you know, we think that Pinterest is both a blessing and a curse, because similar to showing a precedent image is going to get the client a lot closer to understanding what we're going for, rather than like elaborate drawings and hand gestures. So it's like, this is what the stair is going to look like. Okay, yeah. Like it or not, but anyway.
And you can render it. And you can render it.
That's there you
right.
go. There you
so
go.
You have a real advantage because that's exactly what I do. My music is rendered into the what it will sound like into the final form. Whereas you're showing, as an architect, showing your architectural designs and stuff, and rendered into something what it will look like almost exactly. So another connection here, you know, how similar we are in a lot of things. It's the creative process.
That's what it is.
So that's the foundation of it all. It's a creative process. And now we have these really cool tools that we can use to impress our clients, and we do.
Exactly. And whether our product are cars, video games, watches, it's all sort of, we share some similar language. But Mr. Donahue, I think that's it. I want to say, everyone, Alien Dark Descent, play the game, live the movies, crap your pants, because this game is scary. And thank Mr. Donahue for his rocking addition to this this sound palette.
Yes, and hopefully the score's coming out soon so they can listen to it. And all fans of Alien can listen to it and get that immersion.
You know, that's the best we could wish for. There's something that goes back to filmmakers and musicians from decades and ages ago. People listen to scores they couldn't get their hands on. So I think that the digital technology, the output of merchandise these days is a lot, it's made for the fans, and I'm glad the fans are going to get it. So I'll cross all my fingers for you, Doyle.
That's right.
Well, everyone, let's thank Doyle for his time, and we will
thank
catch you.
You
next time.
Thank you for having me.